good evening, you guys. K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also hear the co-host, K2 Kilo Echo Yankee. His name is Mel, the former president of the Kings County Radio Club. I haven't done that yet. TechNet meets to have amateurs exchange information. We believe this is an educational process. We think we're running an inexpensive school here. And within the tri-state area, there's an awful lot of brain power. We try to tap into that. We try to find out how all these antennas and transmission lines and feed horns and transmitters and receivers and propagation and satellites. We try to find out how all this stuff works. There's 25 or 26 different kinds of ham radio, 2-meter FM ham radio, the kind you're listening to right now. It's just one of the 26 kinds. And before you give up the hobby, if you're disappointed with it for some reason, make sure you try some of the other 25. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Typical sign-in would sound like WS2N, Paul, and yes. So do we have any check-ins? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
K2GJE, Ed, yes.
W2OSR, and yes.
Okay, so far we've got Ed and Bob. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name, and the word yes at this time. K2RIW.
W-A-2-S-A-Y, Doug, yes.
And W-S-2-N, Paul.
What's the space report?
W-2-O-S-R, Joe, yes. Got it?
Okay. I've got Doug, I got Paul, and I got Joe. Okay, we got more than enough people to get started. Our promise is that we make a sincere effort in the first hour to answer everyone's question that signed in the beginning, at least a brief answer. At roughly 9 o'clock, Mel goes through his mailbag for the newer people who are getting into ham radio, and we answer those questions. After that, Paul has a space report, and then for the rest of the evening, we dig into the more deep subjects. And there's always a good list of those, because there's a small group of people who would like to know at the molecular level and at the atomic level, among other things, what's really happening. Okay, Ed was the first guy who signed in, K2GJE. What would you like to ask us about tonight, Ed? K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. Just a curiosity question as to antennas that are terminated, like a rhombic that's terminated in a resistor, or a folded dipole terminated a resistor, or even a loop terminated. Advantage, disadvantage, why, et cetera, in a short dissertation. Over. Back to Ned.
Yeah, you're reminding me of what I went through in the very beginning, Ed. As a beginning amateur, way back in the late 50s, when I saw some of these antennas that had a resistor inside of them, and I knew that the resistor was going to take some of that valuable RF energy and turn it into heat and waste it, and it didn't get a chance to be radiated into space, my first question is, why in the world would you put a resistor inside of an antenna? Why would you waste that power? I want to radiate it all. And there's some good reasons for it. Most of the antennas you and I use, Ed, like dipoles and Yagis, and I'm trying to think of some of the others, slot antennas, monopoles, you know, rubber ducks and whatever, all of these are standing wave antennas. That means if you really study at the molecular level what's happening, your transmitter by way of the feed line is taking some current out of the left-hand side of the dipole, some electrons out of the left-hand side of the dipole, shoving them to the right-hand side on the first half cycle. And the second half cycle, it takes the ones on the right-hand side and shoves them to the left-hand side. If you really study it enough, you'll find out that a dipole, you would think it radiates all the energy on the first pass. It doesn't. That energy that you're putting into the two halves of the dipole, that charge you're putting in by way of the feed line, let me drop. That energy bounces back and forth something like 10 or 20 times before it finally gets radiated. You could say 5 or 10% of the energy gets radiated into space on each pass. But the majority of the energy is bouncing back and forth in a resonant manner. A little bit similar to what happens when you push your child on a swing. You're pushing the child cyclically at just the right time as they pass through the bottom, and after you push the child 10 times, the amount of deflection of the child on the swing starts becoming a great big deflection. It's like putting energy into a flywheel, putting energy into a pendulum. These are all resonant networks, and you put in energy with just the right phase angle at just the right time, and you build up that energy. Your transmitter is doing that. And the majority of the energy in your dipole is really bouncing back and forth. And that way, it's, in other words, even though the feed line itself may have a 72-ohm feed line and a 72-ohm dipole, and therefore there is no standing wave ratio, you get a perfect match on the transmission line. In the dipole itself, it's running like something like a 10 or a 20-to-1 standing wave ratio. That energy bounces back and forth a whole lot of times before it gets radiated into space. And you can tell what's really happening when you set the dipole at just the right length is that all of those bounces stay in phase with each other, stay co-phase, they stay in step with each other. Make the dipole a little bit long, and now the energy bouncing back and forth starts lagging in time, starts falling out of step, and when you measure the impedance of the dipole, you start finding out, hey, it's an inductive load. And that's because it's a little bit too long and there's lagging energy. All right, so the majority of the antennas you and I use, 95% of them, are all standing wave structures. The energy bounces back and forth. Along comes an antenna like a rhombic or a beverage where you make the antenna itself a large number of wavelengths. Each half wavelength of the antenna may be a radiate
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
If you had the property and you really wanted to make a good rhombic, you might make the whole darn thing 6 wavelengths long, 3 wavelengths on each half of the diamond, if you know what I mean. And each half wavelength is radiating 5% of the energy. And so now, for the first time, you're really building what's called a traveling wave structure. The energy passes down that wire once. And because the wire is so long, it radiates almost all of the energy before it gets to the end. And there at the end, you have a 600-ohm resistor, which whatever is left over, you absorb it. And a good rhombic antenna set up properly has a beautiful antenna pattern, transmits all of the signal in one direction. If you aim that rhombic toward London, a lot of that energy goes toward London and in no other direction. If you didn't have the 600-ohm terminating resistor at the far end, the energy that's left over would bounce back and now start radiating, start traveling down that wire in the opposite direction. When it did that, you would start making a lot of signal in the back lobe. You would start radiating in the reverse direction. So you could say the main resist, the main reason for that resistor in a rhombic or a beverage antenna is to make it have a good front-to-back ratio, to make it a unidirectional antenna. You could, if you want to, remove the resistor, do a little bit of impedance matching at the feed point. The antenna would work beautifully well. The guy in London would hear you equally as loud. But now the guy in Japan, in the other direction, so to speak, you're going to start hearing him, and maybe he's giving you some QR Mary or QR Nancy. There's a thunderstorm going on there. So you'll lose a lot of the front-to-back ratio if you remove the terminating resistor from a beverage or a rhombic antenna. Let me drop. Now, there have been dipoles that you can buy where there's sort of a molded black box in the center of the dipole. The manufacturer tells you it works on all of these bands, and it has this standing wave ratio across all of these frequencies. And that was a fairly popular antenna because with our modern-day rigs, if you didn't want to buy the antenna tuner and the antenna presented a fairly low standing wave ratio across each one of those bands, you didn't have to do a lot of retuning every time you did a QSY. That was a fairly nice antenna to use during a contest. Along comes somebody at ARRL headquarters who took that thing apart and found that there's a resistor inside. And oh boy, all hell broke loose when that happened. Somebody said that the manufacturer is being a charlatan. They're a feather merchant. They're selling us gold, and they're selling us feathers and charging us for gold. You know what I mean? All kinds of accusations were made. Well, it turns out that everything in life is a compromise. You can make an antenna more broadband if you're willing to put resistors inside of it. So if the antenna doesn't require very much retuning when you change from one end of the band to the other end of the band during a contest, and if 60% of the power is radiated and 40% is burned up in the resistor in order to get that characteristic, which is bringing you down, two-thirds of an S unit in signal strength, you might be willing to make that particular sacrifice, and in some circumstances, that's a good design antenna. But in general, if you want super high efficiency, you'd like to make sure that all of your components of the antenna have no resistance to them. So there's a compromise there, as you can tell. Maybe that helps a little bit, Ed. 72GJE, wait for the beep. K2LIW in the tech net.
K2GJE. The conclusion I'm coming to is that if the antenna and you have the real estate can be made longer, you probably will dissipate less power in that resistor. Clarify me on that. Back to that.
As they say in that movie, give that man a cigar. You've got the concept, Ed. If you've got the real estate and you can make that rhombic big enough, the gain goes up, the beam width goes down, the effective radiated power goes up, the amount of energy left over going into the resistor decreases, the antenna becomes more efficient, and so that's one of the compromises. You can make the rhombic smaller and smaller if you want to. It'll have less gain, and you'll be burning up more power in the resistor if you want it to have a good front-to-back ratio. You've got the idea. So it turns out that radiating a signal off of a piece of wire is hard. You'd like to believe that as long as you put that signal onto your dipole or your other pieces of wire, the signal just immediately jumps off there and goes into space and radiates. It's not that easy. In the case of an ordinary half-wave dipole, you could say that the energy bounces back and forth 10 or 20 times. You've got to kick the signal, you've got to kick those electrons, so to speak, in the tail 10 or 20 times before that energy of that signal finally radiates into space. And what we call resonance really means that there's a higher Q to the antenna when you make it resonant, when you make it just the right length. That means the current that flows is higher. That means that the current flowing higher makes a stronger magnetic field. And I'm slowly concluding that the beginning of the magnetic field is the real beginning of the radiating process, because not one single electron, per se, leaves your antenna when you're transmitting. So you've got the concept. Good question, Ed. Back to you for any final. K2GJE, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you very much. Curiosity satisfied. K2GJE, back to net. Over.
Hey, Mel, sounds like we got a satisfied customer there. We got to send him a bill. Okay, Bob's the next guy, W2OSR. And Mr. Secretary, it was what you used to be, and now I think you're on the board of directors for Limarca. How in the world could you have any question, Bob? W2OSR, having some fun with you. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Question on that subject? Okay, we'll see how you want to pick that up, Dick, in a minute. Get my question out. This is Bob, W2OSR. Everybody knows that cares. I just recently bought an antenna from 412. It's called an LFA antenna. The driven element is a loop, almost like, looks like a little bit like a folded dipole. However, instead of being vertical as you would normally expect it, it's laid flat. That part I kind of understand. Modeled it, looks good. However, the feed is directly fed at the driven element with a piece of coax. The center lead on the coax, there is a rod that is connected there and goes down the beam a distance of about 20 or so inches, and this is a 2-meter Yagi. My wife just got out of the car, and I'll be heading into the house shortly, hopefully.
Bob, you're in the middle of describing the antenna, and I'm not sure you finished the description, and I haven't heard the question yet. Although I think the question is going to be, what in the world's going on here? Back to you, Bob, if you're still there.
I'm just trying to figure out what that rod that goes from the driven element down and connects to the mast is doing.
Okay, you said that it's a Yagi. From that, I'm going to presume that it's a horizontally polarized, or it could be a vertically polarized Yagi. You didn't say how many elements. I presume the Yagi is, the boom of the Yagi is mounted at right angles to the mast. And then the center conductor of the feed line has a rod that goes down the mast. You didn't say whether or not it does connect to any other part of the Yagi. So there's a lot missing to the picture. I know the picture is fairly clear in your mind, but the words you've given us so far, Bob, having given us a picture, and I haven't seen the LFA antenna yet. I presume that's the model number by a particular brand name. I'll go ahead with some more description, Bob. W2OSR, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. Let's first of all get the boom length out of the way. 12-foot boom length, 7 elements. And as I said, the driven element is a folded dipole of some sort. This rod that I'm talking about goes from one of the terminals on the driven element and travels down the boom a distance of about 20 or so inches, and that is hard connected to the boom. That, unlike what I would have thought, you know, you connect the ground side of the coax to that. No, you connect the center conductor of the coax to that point. I'm just trying to understand what that rod is doing.
Okay, I'm going to assume you've got... you didn't say it's a horizontal and vertically polarized dipole, although it doesn't matter as much now that I see that the rod is... You said mast before, but now you said boom. So the rod is going down parallel to the boom. I'm going to guess the rod is in the vicinity of a quarter wavelength long, something close to 19 inches, or it could be a little bit less than that. The far end of the rod is grounded to the boom of the Yagi, not the mast, and I presume the shield and center conductor of the feed line going to the driven element is connecting to the two sides of the folded dipole assembly. And so the shield apparently goes directly to one side of the folded dipole. The center conductor goes to the other side of the folded dipole. Center conductor has this rod, which maybe is an eighth of an inch or a quarter of an inch away from the boom, parallel to the boom. It goes down the boom toward the first director, and then it gets grounded to the boom. Is that approximately the picture, Bob? W2OSR, K2RIW.
Yeah, it sounds like you got it pretty well visualized, and just to answer the question, it's horizontally polarizing. I'll be using it for a 2-meter sideband.
Now, the fact that the center conductor, the fact that the shield of the feed line goes directly to half of the folded dipole is a little bit spooky. Is there any kind of a ballonning structure, a ferrite bead around the coax, a coil, a few turns of coil of the transmission line? Is there any way that the shield of the coax that's connected to one half of the folded dipole, is that in any way ungrounded by way of ballon or coiling of the cable, whatever? Or did they tell you to do anything fancy with the shield on that side of the folded dipole? Over to you, Bob, K2RIW.
No, when I wrote a letter to Mark at 412, I asked him that question. I said, do I need a ballon or, you know, a four-man ballon on the feed line? And he said, no. He said, this rod takes, the rod that we're talking about, takes care of any RF that might go down the feed line.
Interesting. Give me a rough guess. The rod itself is what diameter? Spaced how far from the boom, and how long is the rod? Is the rod less than 19 inches, for instance? Bob, go ahead.
Dick, it's actually a bit longer than 19 inches. It's a piece of flat aluminum stock, maybe a 16th of an inch thick and about 3/8 of an inch wide. And in order to clear the other elements which are all insulated from the boom, it kind of goes up in the air and is about 3 inches at some point above the boom itself.
Wow. So this piece of sheet metal that you're calling a rod is more than 19 inches long. 19 inches would be a quarter wave. Usually the first director is less than a quarter wave away from the driven element. So I think I'm getting the impression that it lies parallel to the boom for a short distance, then does a bridging, an inchworm maneuver to go over the first director, and I think you said it goes 3 inches in the air, And then I presume it comes back down and continues parallel to the boom. In the places where it's parallel to the boom, what is the spacing between that piece of sheet metal and the boom? Over to you, Bob.
Dick, it starts out as the driven element, arches up, goes up to that 3-inch height, and falls down to about 2 inches above the boom, just before it bends back down and you have the hard connection to the boom. It's a little odd. You may want to go look at the 412 website at some point just to see what this thing looks like. It's a design that was developed by somebody in England, and I guess 412 has the license for it here in the States.
It sounds a little bit like what's called a hairpin feeding mechanism. Okay, so you've got this, I'm going to call it an inductor, but if it's more than 19 inches, it's actually capacitive. It's a capacitive loading device, very low insertion loss, a little bit of radiation it's going to do. And I guess I'm going to have to see the picture. They've created with that a partial radiator, but I don't think that's the main function. It sounds to me like it is a reactor between center conductor and ground, which tries to force balancing. Ordinarily, the signal flowing down a piece of coax cable, the signal really is between center conductor and the inner surface of the outer braid. That's where the signal really is flowing. And from one point of view, you could say all of the signal is on the center conductor, because the outer braid is really a kind of piece of waveguide beyond cutoff, and there's no real signal on it, even on the inner surface, but at least it's the return path. You take that piece of coax cable and try to feed a balanced structure, like a folded dipole. Let me drive. And now you're taking this unbalanced signal and trying to feed a balanced structure, and the net result would be that the center conductor is feeding more signal to the right-hand side of the folded dipole than where the shield is connected to the left-hand side in my little example. Therefore, you're doing an unbalanced feed to the folded dipole. That's not a disaster. At first, you would guess that the right-hand side of the dipole would have more signal than the left-hand side. That's not the way it works at all, because the majority of the signal, 90-some-odd% of the signal, is really bouncing back and forth between the two halves. Mother Nature forces a kind of balance, even though you're feeding it in an unbalanced manner. So it's not a disaster. But by way of this extra inductive structure, and that's what reactive, this extra reactive structure, they're forcing a little bit more of a balance. These are some of my early guesses. When I get a chance, I'm going to take a look at that website for Force 12 for the LSR, and I think you said LFA antenna. I think you said it's a 7-element Yagi. Is that true, Bob? Go ahead.
Yeah, 7-element Yagi. Free space gain is about 12 dB. When I modeled it at a given height, and we all know that that's a kind of a fictitious number, I came up with about 17 dB of gain. But, somewhere between 17 and 12 is probably what I'm really going to get out of it. But all that remains to be seen. Front to back ratio is pretty good. It's about 20-something to 1.
Yeah, funny you should say this, because at a UHF frequency, I've spent the last month physically modeling a 7-element Yagi, trying to tune for the maximum gain on an antenna range where I believe I've got accuracy of better than half a dB, repeatability and accuracy, by way of a network analyzer on a quasi-anechoic antenna range. And 7 elements carefully tuned can give you approximately 12.5 decibels of gain over a isotropic. 12.5 dB over isotropic can be had with 7 elements with pretty careful tuning. And maybe you could stretch that to 13, but not a hell of a lot more in the real world. I think if you go to the Gunter Hawk curves for what gains have really been realized, and some of these computer modeling programs sometimes come up with some pretty crazy numbers. Anything greater than 13 dB over isotropic, which would be 11 dB over dipole, I wouldn't believe it, if you know what I mean. Sounds good. Now, I know that I think it was Joe had a question on the previous question. So let's see if Joe wants to ask that question right now. W2RYY, if that was you. K2RYW, go ahead, Joe.
Matt of Dick in the house, W2OSR.
Very fine, Bob. We'll look into this a little bit further, and maybe we'll pick it up again a little later. You got it, Joe.
Does operating a rhombic off the ground in a spacing of, say, like a quarter wavelength, half wavelength, or more, have any adverse effect on the radiation pattern of the antenna? Back to you.
Yeah, whenever you put any of these rhombic, beverage, Yagi, almost any of the antennas at most of the frequencies that you and I care about, Joe, when you put them above the ground, you don't realize it, but there really is a real antenna above the ground and a mirror image of an antenna below the ground. You and I look at ground, we see dirt and grass and gravel and concrete and whatever. To most of these RF frequencies, that ground is almost a mirror. It's not a perfect mirror. It's a slightly foggy or slightly dirty mirror. So there's a real antenna above ground and there's one below ground. And so those two antennas are beating against each other. The net result is that you don't get a signal exactly on the horizon when you're using, say, horizontal polarization. The two antennas fall slightly out of phase, mostly out of phase with each other. That gives you a null on the horizon. So as you change the altitude of your rhombic antenna, you're primarily steering the vertical lobe. How many degrees above the ground is, how many degrees above the horizon is a function of how many wavelengths the antenna is above the ground. The presence of the ground slightly changes the feed impedance of the rhombic. That's a minor factor because you can always readjust that with an antenna tuner or other methods of changing the physical layout of the rhombic. So you get a minor change in impedance. You get a little bit of ground loss, yes, but you're really primarily determining the angle of elevation, as you said, altitude. Some of the really smart guys trying to do a serious 2-meter moon bounce with rhombics not only made them a zillion wavelengths long, you know, 1,000-foot type antennas on 2 meters, but they also stacked a number of rhombics above each other to give them a little bit more control of this ground radiation characteristic. If you had the right computer modeling program or the right book and graphs to look it up, you could determine exactly what elevation angle is going to be the peak of the beam of your rhombic, dependent on whether or not you tilted the rhombic, how many wavelengths it is above the ground, and whether or not you stacked a number of rhombic-like elements. W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Okay, thanks, Dick. From what you're saying, it basically sounds to me like half wavelength or less, or even approaching up to one wavelength, would give you a pattern that going near the horizon or pretty close to the horizon, and above that would not make too much difference as far as above the horizon, as far as degrees, correct?
There, I'm not sure, Joe. I'm really not sure. What you're asking is there a law of diminishing return of half wavelength or one wavelength above the ground with a rhombic where any higher doesn't buy you anything? Don't really know. Guarantee somebody's written an article on that. Guarantee one of the better computer modeling programs will allow you to plug in those numbers and see what happens. I do know that those rhombics that they set out at RCA transmitting facility out in Rocky Point, those rhombics were on stacked telephone poles and more than 200 feet in the air. So where they put forth all of that effort to make these very high-gain rhombic antennas, 200 feet in the air. Guaranteed they had good reason to believe they were getting the benefit of doing that. Otherwise, they wouldn't put forth that much effort. So, when you do find out more about that, Joe, please come back and tell us. Because my gut feel is that you keep getting some benefit, and it's a matter of, is there a law of diminishing returns? Is it not worth all the effort to go beyond a certain number of wavelengths? But out there at Rocky Point, they did it. The next person on the list was Doug, W2SAY. And I presume you're coming in on the Eastern input and hope it's working pretty well tonight, Doug. W2SAY, K2RIW.
Before we go on, Dick, I have one question about this rhombic.
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, did you ever see in your past times the San Diego naval towers before they, you know, blew them up over?
I might not, or at least I don't remember them right now, so go ahead and describe them to us. What did you see in those pictures, Mel? Go ahead.
Well, I was out there some years ago and went to see them. They were 600-foot towers, I believe. Big, heavy, massive structures. You know, built like from the, I believe they were built in the 30s. It was for communications to the Pacific. And in fact, the Navy Department, you know, and the Army were sort of always at some kind of odds. So when the Army originally couldn't contact Pearl Harbor December 7, 1941, they didn't want to turn it over to the Navy Department, because the Navy said, the Army said, if the Navy can't contact them, we couldn't. Yet these antennas were fantastic for throughout World War II of being able to contact, keep good contact on the Pacific constantly, and it was kind of an unusual looking antenna, Dick, over.
Yeah, give us a couple of descriptions. So you got 600 foot high towers, how many of them, and was it a rhombic like structure on top of those, Mel, go ahead.
Well, like I say, they were tall, and yeah, I think so. Except what they did, for what you can see from the ground, it looked like, not like in a, you know, always saw in World War II, 1930, you know, building those antennas in the form of a square, you know, using those insulators, those cross insulators, and forming it that way. But these were like three wire something, some kind of, for what I can make out, there wasn't a fourth wire stick. It was like three wires and sort of like, I can almost say like an, say that they were like curved to the Pacific, over.
Now when you say three wires, are you talking about the arms of the rhombic? Are you talking about the transmission line? You didn't say what the three wires are. And were the three wires held together with some kind of a Y-shaped insulating structure with 120 degree difference between the arms? I mean, were the three wires trying to make an arm look larger in diameter, or were the three wires used in some kind of a transmission line? Over to you, Mel.
Not sure. It was, looked like, from what I could gather, there wasn't anyone around at that time that you could talk to. There were no tours or anything. All I could see is from what I was gathering with somebody happened to be standing there with a pair of binoculars, so I was able to take a quick peek. And I could see it look like a Y, yes, like a Y-type device holding three wires. I thought maybe you would be familiar more with that antenna, what kind of a setup that was. But all right, I could further research it out one day, over.
Yeah, if this was the best of all worlds, you'd like to make the arms of a HF antenna out of a piece of tubing that is, let me pick a number, 12 inches in diameter. Of course, that would be very heavy and very difficult. But you can fool the RF. You could set three wires in a triangular pattern where the three wires are close to a foot apart from each other. And because of the skin effect and whatever, it'll give you much of the benefit of a piece of tubing that diameter. Your extremely high voltage, your 300 kilovolt and 500 kilovolt and 1 megavolt type transmission lines for power across the United States quite often use this technique of two wires side by side or three wires side by side in order to make the conductor look larger in diameter. Therefore, they get less corona effects, less arcing, and the fact that the three wires, they're dividing the current 3-to-1, and they're getting one-third the resistance, getting a lot more efficiency benefit. So there are various ways of fooling the signal, whether it be a 60-cycle signal on a power transmission line, or whether it be a 6-megacycle signal for a over-the-Pacific communication network. Making that conductor look larger in diameter gives you a little more bandwidth, a little bit lower Q, a little bit higher efficiency, and if you're running real high power, less corona discharge, and so it's a good way to go if you've got the resources. Let's see what Doug is asking us now. W-A-2-S-A-Y. Try again, Doug. K-2-R-I-W. And the TechNet listens for you.
That is WA2SAY. All right, the question I had sent you an email, but I guess you used this theater to get around to answering it. Anyway, the question I have is on guy wires. I want to put up a Christmas tree of antennas about maybe 10, 13, 12 feet above a tripod on the roof. You know, in other words, they will be 10 or 12 feet or thereabouts of mass for the rotator, then the rotator, and then about 5 or 6 feet of more pipe with antennas on it. 20-meter audio antenna dipole, a 2-meter beam, a 6-meter beam, and an FM antenna. Anyway, I think with that arrangement, I'm going to have to guy the rotator. And the question is, what kind of wire and where do I get it? How big should it be? And that sort of thing. Tell me all about guy wires.
All right, you've come to the right place. I'm a strong enthusiast of guy wires. They've been holding up my structures since 1965. That's when I first put up 60 feet of tower, held up with multiple sets of guy wires. I think it was a total of 6 guy wires at 2 different levels. And then in 1969, I put up 100 feet of tower with 4 sets of guy wires. And now I've got 2 separate towers with 4 kinds of guy wires. I have used Montgomery Ward 9-gauge fence wire, galvanized covered fence wire, 9-gauge steel, reasonably good guy wire, although its longevity is kind of limited. After about 8 or 10 years, it starts showing some serious rust because the galvanizing on it, I think, is a simple electroplating process, not hot dipped, therefore it's not a very thick layer of galvanizing. But the guy wire is... I personally put it on the AIL tensile testing machine. Let me drop. And I can tell you a loop of 9-gauge galvanized Montgomery Ward, the company's name at that time, fence wire, failed at roughly 900 pounds, 900 pounds of tension. And that's, for most of the kind of guying you would do, that would be good enough, except for the fact that it doesn't have the longevity. The most famous kind of guy wire, the easiest stuff to get a hold of, because reels of it are left all over on Long Island in various places, and I could even get you some of it if you need it bad enough, is quarter-inch diameter, 7-strand guy wire, which the Graybar catalog calls 6M, 6 Mike, and that stands for 6,000-pound test. The stuff has really got an ultimate tensile strength of 6,650 pounds, but it's quarter-inch diameter, 7 strands, and a... very predictable pattern, and twisted 7 strands, and as I said, that quarter inch guy wire is more than enough. Although it starts showing some rust after 10 or 12 years, you wouldn't have to worry about the rust giving you any substantial change in strength for at least 20 years, as long as the rust is not sustaining your roof, if you know what I mean. So that's the Cadillac of guy wires for your particular operation, 6M quarter inch diameter. You could also use 3/16 diameter. It's a little bit more rare, but I have seen stranded guy wire 6M, 3/16. And there probably is somebody who makes a quarter-inch stranded, but I haven't seen it. The most important thing with guy wires, let me drop, is that don't bend it with a sharp bend around the screw eye, so to speak, wherever the screw eye is on either end of the guy wire, because you sacrifice a lot of the strength if it's got a sharp bend. Make sure you're putting a thimble in there, and good hardware stores have got these thimbles, which gives it a nice radius of bend around the around whatever screw eye like thing or turnbuckle that you're using. Make sure you use thimbles. And I'm a strong advocate of guy clips, 2 or 3 guy clips, where the guy clip, the U-shaped object on the guy clip, is bearing on the non-working end of the guy wire. And 2 or 3 guy clips properly installed give you full strength of the guy wire, easy to inspect. They do have these things that people put on the end which are much faster, called big end, big grip. They got various names for them. but they've got nasty failure mechanisms that they look good today and can come apart tomorrow. So I'm not an enthusiast of those. Yeah, they save you a few minutes on each individual connection, but that's a rather poor investment from my point of view. If I invest another 10 or 15 minutes on each end of each guy wire, properly serving it, properly putting thimbles and guy clips and doing all that kind of jazz, and then I've got something that I can easily inspect, and I know it's going to give me a very good service for the next 20 years. To me, that's a very good investment. And saving 10 minutes on each guy wire by using some other slightly more flaky technique, that's not my way of doing it. In your case, where that TP mount is probably going to go in the high portion of the roof of your house, and then the guying maybe is going to take place on the corners of the house with great big lag bolts that go into the rafters. That's one way of doing it. Or if you've got the real estate, you could bring them all the way to the ground, as long as you've got ways of hiding them.
Repeater, time out, cancel.
As long as you can hide them against a fence or something, or against a tree, alongside of a tree, where people are not likely to walk into the guy wire. You'd rather not bring a guy wire at a 45-degree angle down to the middle of your lawn, where somebody can come walking across your lawn and run into that guy wire. You've got to worry about the people impacting the guy wire, Doug. I'm sure you've already considered this. As long as your house has got some fairly strong rafters that you can screw into, there's all kinds of ways you can get some very strong support points on the corners of the roof of the house. So the A2SAY, A2RIW in the TechNet.
WA2SAY back to net. Okay, that sounds good. The when you say 9-gauge wire, is that the same kind of gauge as American wire gauge? In other words, I could just look up AWG and find out what diameter 9-gauge is. I was over at Home Depot a week or so ago, and they've got some really strange gauges. You know, I don't know what they mean, but it isn't anything like 8 or 9 or anything. You know, it's some cockamamie number, maybe it's millimeters or something. So I figure out what size wire I actually need. I'll take a micrometer over there and measure what they have. The next question, of course, where do I get the rest of this hardware, the thimbles and the guy clips and all of that stuff? Back to you, Dick.
Worst comes to worst, you can always get them from the Unaco Roan Company, but you don't have to go that far, mail order or whatever. There are hardware stores on Long Island that definitely carry these. David Brown in Smithtown, he's out of business, unfortunately. He had all that kind of hardware. There's a good-sized hardware store on the south side of Veterans Highway, not too far away from the airport in Islip. Can't even think of the name of the Don Airport right now. MacArthur. Just a little bit west of MacArthur Airport on the south side of Veterans Highway is a very good-sized hardware store that has that kind of hardware. Thimbles, turnbuckles, great big screw-eye type devices, threaded, you know, as a machine bolt or threaded ready to go into a chunk of wood directly, guy clips. Also, many of the flea markets will have these things. One particular guy will be selling this kind of hardware. So it does exist on Long Island. I'll admit that only 5% of the hardware stores stock this kind of stuff because it doesn't have a great deal of turnaround. I don't know if Lowe's has it. I'm a little skeptical as to whether or not Home Depot has it. I think Home Depot, if you dig deep enough, they've got guy clips. And I believe I've seen symbols there because people are usually setting up. Let me drop.
Where is an Ace Hardware, KC2QIQ?
Yeah, give me that one again, Glenn. The Ace Hardware that you've seen it, what town did you see it? Because not each and every Ace Hardware has the same hardware. So which town did you see that kind of hardware at Ace, Glenn? Go ahead.
I can tell you.
That's right in Bohemia. It's right off of Veterans Highway. It's actually almost within walking distance of where I work, Dick. So it's right around the block over there. And yes, they definitely have a lot of stainless steel hardware as well. But that is an Ace Hardware, the one you were talking about, KC2QIQ.
Comment.
That's good to know. And go ahead, Ed, with your comment.
The hardware store is on
Veterans Highway between Ocean and Locust, and he has galvanized multi-strand cable. Over.
Very good, Ed. That's good to know. The so-called 9-gauge galvanized fence wire, that's what the Montgomery Ward catalog called it. I don't remember what I measured, but my rough estimate is it's in the vicinity of an eighth of an inch in diameter, and that was good for 900 pounds, which I think would be good enough in your particular application. The only slight disadvantage of that wire is that it's a little bit stiffer, requires some tools to properly form it around the thimble and get it ready to accept the guy clips, and the fact that the galvanizing is not hot dipped, it's electroplated, not very thick, and it starts showing rust in a little bit less than 10 years. But maybe, and I've let that kind of guy wire sit on my tower for well over 15 years, maybe 18 years, showing a moderate amount of rust, but still doing the job. Those were the auxiliary guy wires that I had on the yardarm that was holding the satellite dish off to one side. I separately guyed it so it didn't create any twist on the tower when the wind blew. So with a little bit of shopping around, you'll find all of this hardware, and very glad to hear that you're doing guying, because you'd be amazed how many people in your application, Doug, who think they can use a strong enough TP mount and a strong enough mast and don't think they need guying. When it comes to real wind survival, guy wires are where it's at. That's where the rubber meets the road. W2SAY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2KY, give you some advice.
Okay, let me pick up Doug first and then Mel in that order. Go ahead, Doug.
I think the directions there to the hardware store on Vez Highway are very good, and that's not too far from here, so that's no problem. I'll probably take a ride over there tomorrow or the next day and see if I can pick up all this stuff. You said I think I know what you mean by thimbles. What do you mean by guy clips? Is that little tiny, U-shaped things with a saddle on them that you can put around the cable, the guy cable to terminate it?
You've got it, Doug. Let me drop it. The thimbles, and we got Mel in comment in that order. Stand by. The thimbles, when you see them side view, they are a tear-shaped object, which has got a channel down the center of them that the wider... The big opening is where the eye bolt or the turnbuckle eye goes. The wire itself sits in that channel that's around this tear-shaped object. So now the wire has got a nice round saddle to sit into. It doesn't have a sharp bend. The guy clips, yes, they are a U-shaped piece of metal, which is threaded on the two ends of the U. They go into a saddle-like device. So you lay the two strands of the wire into the saddle. You put the U-shaped object over top. It goes through the saddle, and you attach the two nuts on the back side. That is a guy clip, properly tightened. A pair of those, or three of them, if you want to be conservative, gives you the full strength of the guy wire. Make sure that the U-shaped piece of metal with the two screw threads on the end, make sure that that is bearing on the non-working end of the guy wire if you want to develop full strength. So those guy clips are good. Hardware stores have those. Let's see what Mel can say, because Mel's done an awful lot of guying. K2KEY. K2RIW. You got it, Mel.
Okay, if you have a problem and you want to talk to people that are very knowledgeable about different types of guy wires, rings, all kinds of things that, well, they sell the product, of course, also, but they're very knowledgeable and very friendly. You can look in QFP, back of the book, usually you'll see Texas Towers. And they have special, their specialty is, you know, they sell a number of different makes of towers, especially U.S. towers and a couple of the others, and they're very coding. And I'll tell you why. I just want to hear your opinion first, over.
Way back in my youth, I did paint guy wires as a method of trying to make them last longer before they rust. I forget what I used for paint, but it wasn't very successful.
What I do definitely do, and I'm very happy about this, is that where the guide clips and the thimbles and the turnbuckles and all of that jazz is being connected at each end of the guy wire, my favorite thing to do is to then spray it with zinc-rich paint. Zinc-rich paint, zinc-bearing paint, does an extremely good job. It's second only to hot-dip galvanizing as far as rust prevention is concerned. It's mostly for beauty reasons, but to look at all that guying hardware and to see it 5 years later and seeing a nice gray coating of the zinc-rich paint on there and no evidence of rust, that gives me a warm and fuzzy feeling. I know that there are some very fancy epoxy-bearing paints, some of which are called rust-converting paints, which probably do an even better job. So what's your favorite way of covering the hardware? The guy wire itself, I'm having trouble believing you gain very much by covering the guy wire with something. I'd rather replace it in 15 years if it's starting to show some rust, but maybe you've got a magic formula on this one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
That's definitely after, where I am here, by the ocean. I decided to do an experiment the last time I replaced the guy wire. Let's see now. Okay. That's just 4 or 5 years now. And the last step also, about a dozen years, and they showed, severe rusting. I wouldn't trust them. So what I was watching them do, they were painting this, doing this different painting on this at this time on one of these fences along the water area, the ocean. And the guy was wearing like a special, it's called a painting glove. Believe it or not, it's a glove that paints. That you actually dip in the paint and you work it around, so you can work it around all different things. I looked at that and I said, that's an idea. Well, I got myself a trough. I spread out the guy wire, tied it off between two places. I had a nice trough on the ground about a foot and a half above the guy wire that was now suspended between two places. And with this glove, dipping it in and moving the trough along, I actually worked it along the guy wire and put that zinc coating on that you mentioned, Dick, over.
Yeah, I think that painting glove is again sold by some good hardware stores. I believe it is a stock item from the Unaco Roan company, the company that makes towers, and I think they sell that painting glove, or at least they did at one time. The zinc-rich paint has
4NBC.
Bob also is joining us. The zinc-rich paint, Mel, has xylene in it, and xylene is one of the evaporating substances that's one of its vehicles, and I think xylene is considered a toxic substance. Thank goodness you were doing this outdoors. And maybe the inside of that glove was somehow coated with something that's weatherproof so that you were not in direct contact with the paint. But the xylene that's in zinc-rich paint, I do think you should be a little bit careful with how much your body gets exposed to that. Do you believe your hand was also touching that paint inside of the glove, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
Oh, no, I was very careful. They did express that it had a smell to it, good smell, but the glove, no, you take the glove off, you didn't see a speck on your hand. It's a special-made glove for painting towers and things, which, you can work your hand into all different spots. It's made for painting girders and towers and you name it. It's a special glove. The stuff that I was using, yes, I had to wear a respirator. They advised. Did everything that they said, goggles, respirators, the whole thing, long sleeves. And when I put that finish on it, I take a look at the guy wires, where they come down low in the backyard, and they still look excellent. Believe it or not, I think they're still shining, over.
Yeah, my quick question on this one is, was it hot-dip galvanized guy wire you started off with, and now you put this extra layer of zinc-rich paint on top, and after how many years do they still look pristine? And you've got a severe environment because you're two blocks away from the seashore there on Dover Street in Manhattan Beach on the south shore of Long Island. So after how many years they look how good, and what did the guy wire start off as, Mel? Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW?
They were the commercial-grade guy wire that was suggested by a couple of tower manufacturers. at the time that I spoke to, and Rooney Roan and a couple of the others that were, and it was expensive stuff. This was well made, good guy wire, and it's supposedly got a good galvanization on it, but I saw it previously, it eats through fairly quick, and I was amazed now. This is, I'd say it's 5 years now, and they still look excellent, Dick, over.
Yeah, that's a good testimonial. And by the way, some of the better made guy wires are called EHS, Echo Hotel Sierra. That stands for Extremely High Strength Steel. It's a hard drawn steel for each of the seven strands, and you get a lot of strength for the diameter out of EHS type guy wire. 3/16 or quarter inch diameter is my recommendation in your case, Doug. And if you have trouble finding the guy wire, I can find some of that for you. Now, we've got a person who wants to make a comment, plus Bob, K4NBC, in that order. The person who wants to make a comment, go right ahead. Give me your identification, K2RIW in the SECNAT. Okay, maybe that person got called away. Bob, K4NBC. You've also got a very severe environment down there in Florida where I guarantee that sea spray can do some terrible things to your hardware if you don't do fancy things to protect it. So give us a few of the words that you've used. Bob, by the way, is a guy who's down to his last two, count them, two towers of roughly 190 feet each in altitude of Rhone 55. So he's a tower man from way back. K4NBC, K2RIW on the TechNet.
All right, good evening, Dick. Mel from K4NBC in Florida. First, let me jump to back one subject there. The RCA radio towers that Mel was referring to, I sent you an email link to the YouTube video there, Dick. It was called Radio Jim River. Radio Jim River was the station. It was in Washington State, up in the Cascade Mountains, and it put out 1,000,000 watts on HF. There's pictures of the towers in the video, and they're one-of-a-kind towers. Never saw anything like them in my life. One-of-a-kind. Next subject, towers and guy wires. I'm up 200 feet. And I'm using what they call cable TV strand. Got it for nothing from the cable company on short spools. And what a short spool is, like 250, 300 feet. So they just simply call it strand. And I'm holding up my tower with nothing but preforms. A preform is a wrap with its own built-in... it intertwines around the guy wire and grabs it. You wind both ends of it helically, and they interlock with each other, and there's a, they put stuff on it.
Yeah, I think Bob may have timed out his local machine. Let's wait a little bit and see if Bob comes back. And by the way, those preforms are a very nice, fast way of servicing guy wires on the two ends. And for a place like Florida, I think they're quite appropriate. For a place like us up here north, where we sometimes get ice on the wire, and ice sliding down the wire can definitely open up those preforms. And multiple times in history that has happened. There's a kind of a simple 10-cent metal clip that goes over the end of the preform on the bottom guy wire, at the grounded end, so to speak, which makes sure that ice hitting it can't spread it. To be double darn sure when you're using a preform, I would want to use at least one U-shaped saddled guy clip at the most forward tip of a preform to make sure that ice sliding down the tower couldn't separate it. That's my feeling as a bent, you know, belt and suspenders. They're very nice, but in a winter area, there is this hazard, and a hell of a lot of people think that that little metal clip on the end is not important, and they don't bother putting it on. And then the next ice storm comes along, the tower falls down. K4NBC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, I'm back. I'll have to watch the timer there. Yeah, well, I'm just holding up the tower with preforms, and I do have U-clips on the preforms to help keep the wire from pulling out of them in hurricane situations. And I've been through about 8